For the Climate Discussion Nexus, I'm John Robson with the latest readout video from our free Wednesday Wake Up email newsletter, to both of which you should subscribe if you don't already, and both of which you should support if you don't already. And again, I want to thank all the people who have made use of the thanks button on YouTube to help support our work. Whereas we should not, and will not, attempt to yodel in thanking all of those who've made Switzerland number 18 on our all-time list of views by jurisdiction. Instead, a real climate tipping point. As we noted in our previous newsletter and readout video, Bill Gates has changed his mind on the changing climate, at least as far as acknowledging that people have far bigger problems to worry about, like poverty and disease. And apparently, he's not alone. Having written those words, we then received one of those tiresome clickbait experts available emails that universities now send out instead of teaching the classics. This one was from the University of Ottawa about the floundering COP30 conference. But to our amazement, it led off with Dr. Ian D. Clark, Professor Emeritus of Earth and Environmental Sciences, declaring, quote, "Our environment has much more serious challenges than our CO2 emissions, which are blamed without scientific merit for many environmental events," end quote. Under, admittedly, an image of someone holding a burning globe. But since these missives are clickbait and they can now contain that kind of thing, it's clear that the mood has changed. You can now say, indeed you could now lead, with there not being an existential climate crisis. What's more, even the subsequent items in that email, though they did feature alarmism, often had this unaccustomed flavor of promoting adaptation rather than focusing solely on emission reductions. So, there is a welcome and long overdue recognition among many alarmists that what they've been doing has not worked and can't work. In which regard, in the newsletter, we then noted that there's no logical connection between the seriousness of a problem and the plausibility of various solutions. In principle, it's easy to imagine things that aren't serious and are easy to solve, like morning coffee not yet made. Things that aren't serious and are hard to solve, like instant coffee tastes terrible. Things that are serious and are easy to solve, like set stove on fire making morning coffee. And things that are serious and are hard to solve, like set planet on fire making morning coffee. Therefore, to change one's mind on whether a problem is serious doesn't require changing one's mind on whether it's easy to solve. And yet there does seem to be a simultaneous retreat underway on both with respect to climate. People are now admitting that global warming isn't a serious problem, while also recognizing that it wouldn't be easy to stop it if it were. Oh, and in the newsletter, we note yet another tipping point. The demise of Mark Carney's beloved short-lived GFANZ may well be followed by the, whoever heard of it, Dairy Methane Action Alliance, which only started in December 2023, but Nestle has already bailed. The company burbled the usual cover story about how it works best on climate alone, setting its own rules and grading its own work and continuing to, make money. But we dare speculate that they actually discovered that the climate alarmist's prescriptions would destroy the economy without fixing the weather, starting with them, and that volunteering to go first has no upside. If, on the other hand, you want climate catastrophe, we got climate catastrophe. Courtesy of MSN, who forgot their script and brought us, quote, "When it rained for 2 million years, the forgotten climate crisis of the Triassic," end quote. Now that's big bad weather. And a big bad name, the Carnian Pluvial Event. Yes, before man invented bad weather. And the article concedes, quote, "long before humans worried about climate change," end quote. See, the Earth was recovering from the Permian mass extinction event. And lab dudes, if you're going to call them all event, maybe just leave it off. Anyway, now new life forms were proliferating in a world that was getting warmer and wetter. Then came this bizarre endless storm that, among other things, raised temperature further, and a great many species flourished even more dramatically, from conifers and ferns to, especially, the rising dinosaurs. Ah, and nobody knows why. Gad, is everything we're told about climate wrong? And another thing, while battling some ignorant political blather about unprecedented uncertainty in the modern world, one of us found ourselves Googling the exact date of the sack of Rome by Alaric, which was 410 AD. And look what some unwary editor allowed to remain in Wikipedia. Quote, "A recent summary interprets disease and climate change as important drivers of the political collapse of the empire. There was a Roman climatic optimum from about 200 BCE to 150 CE when lands around the Mediterranean were generally warm and well-watered. This made agriculture prosperous, army recruitment easy, and the collection of taxes straightforward. From about 150, the climate became on average somewhat worse for most of the inhabited lands around the Mediterranean. After about 450, the climate worsened further in the late antique Little Ice Age that may have directly contributed to the variety of factors that brought Rome down," end quote. What do you know? Civilization and people flourish in warmth, and disaster strikes when it gets colder. Why weren't we told? Then, why were we told this? Strange item from the Financial Times, blaming slumping oat milk sales on climate change. Which is taking "there's nothing it cannot do" a bit far, surely. One might simply blame the fact that it's not milk because it came from an oat. But the story goes, quote, "Oatly's chief executive said greenwashing and doom and gloom talk around climate change had put U.S. consumers off sustainability, as sales of plant-based dairy alternatives go into reverse after years of growth." Quoting him, "In the past, when people were talking about climate change or sustainability, it was in a doom and gloom, in a punitive, in a very negative way, and people got fed up with that," end quote, said Jean-Christophe Flatin. Well, how else can you scare people into giving up the stuff that we've been drinking with pleasure and profit since the invention of agriculture, the one that also gives us butter and cheese? Oat camembert? No thanks. As the retreat from climate alarmism threatens to become a rout, some are repeating the classic advice Senator George Aiken of Vermont did not actually give on the Vietnam War back in 1966, quote, "Let's declare victory and get out," end quote. Most notably, the New York Times Climate Forward, which had the gall to email a link to this chart as, quote, "some of our best climate reporting from the week," end quote. In that case, we'd hate to see the worst, given their chronic drumbeat of "we're missing the targets, we're all going to die" reporting up to that point. And given how the current pathway slopes downward, despite being a temperature increase of 2.5 Celsius to 2.9 Celsius, surely leading to catastrophe since 1.5 was the red line, blah, blah, blah. And because it's all purely hypothetical, since actual emissions are rising rather than fitting their new improved curve. But their read on that chart is, quote, "slower emissions growth means the arc of temperature increase has curved downward over the past 10 years, end quote, and it's, quote, "a significant improvement from where we were 10 years ago. In 2015, scientific models said we were on track to increase the global average temperature by up to 3.8 degrees Celsius, end quote. So, now the scientific models say something else because they were told to say something else, and all we need to do is fiddle yet more parameters and have graphics do their thing, as with those old Pentagon body counts, and we're out of here. Real world? What real world? And another defector. It's not just Bill Gates who's suddenly looking less panicky on global warming, nor just Michael Schellenberger, who in 2007 co-authored an apocalyptic book, Breakthrough, From the Death of Environmentalism to the Politics of Possibility, along with Ted Nordhaus, nephew of Nobel Prize-winning economist William Nordhaus. But Schellenberger has become a scathing critic of climate hysteria, and so has Nordhaus, the nephew, who's repudiating his own youthful alarmist views as, quote, hyperbole, end quote. Perhaps we're a bit late here, and that he first clearly explained his apostasy back in August. But he's back at it, and it's a powerful illustration not only of how people might move from confusion to clarity, but also of the fact that climate alarmism was never a hoax for the vast majority of advocates and followers, but a sincere error. People like Gates and Nordhaus don't say, "Yeah, I was part of a sinister cabal plotting to enslave and destroy mankind by making up science." What they say is, "I sincerely believe these things, but now I've changed my mind, and here's why." And as we ourselves said with what might have seemed bizarre optimism back in June of this year, for all its apparent momentum, climate alarmism was actually on the verge of collapsing because it was becoming intellectually unsustainable. And evidently, an increasing number of alarmists actually agree. The more the merrier. But we're not out of the woods yet, or the frozen wasteland. Because last week, we reported on new evidence that the Antarctic Peninsula, imaginatively known as AP, has been experiencing significant cooling over the past 20 years. But we hinted that if it's warming you want, they can give you warming too. Because with climate change, you get to have it both ways. And so, with a little digging, we present you with evidence that the significant cooling in the AP is, in fact, warming. The paper we just referred to was published in April 2025, which seems pretty hot off the presses, right? But you only had to wait until June 2025 to get the opposite findings in the form of this paper entitled, quote, "Recent Warming Trends in Antarctica Revealed by Multiple Reanalysis," end quote, which sounds impressive, but too often means torturing data until it confesses. In this chart, the top left panel shows the observed trends from 1980 to 2023. The dots are where the weather stations are, though obviously not to scale. And interestingly, the AP shows the fastest warming of all. And the next five panels show the results from five different reanalysis systems, in all of which the AP comes out deep red, meaning intense warming. But you'll notice that the reanalysis models don't agree with each other very much elsewhere. So sometimes you don't just get to have it both ways, you get to have it five ways. And now for something completely different. From CFACT comes a beautifully simple yet powerful bit of common sense analysis by meteorologist Joe Bastardi. Bastardi, and yes, he should change his name, is the chief meteorologist at WeatherBell.com, and his Sunday summary videos offer this chatty blend of near and medium-term U.S. weather forecasts, commentary on climate alarmism, and complaints about how Penn State's football team is doing. After all the climate emergency declarations and COP conferences and existential threat warnings, Bastardi decided to ask Grok, which is the AI system built into the X platform, how bad the situation really is. So he supplied Grok with the pictures of global temperatures as of October 2025 relative to the 1991 to 2020 average, and asked it to compute the average where 99.8% of the world's population lives, and asked its opinion on whether the change was even detectable, let alone harmful. And somehow, AI became a fountain of common sense, looking at the chart and declaring that 99.8% of humanity lives in areas that, over 30 years, have warmed an average of 0.1 degrees Celsius. He asked Grok whether people would be able to notice a warming that small over 30 years, and the answer was, quote, "A 0.1 degrees Celsius increase over 30 years would have a near-zero direct impact on the human condition, far too small to affect health, food, migration, or economy in any measurable way," end quote. And on it went, making you wonder why the experts who say can't see it. And finally in the newsletter, from the co2science.org archive, water fern, or Azolla pinnata vara pinnata, is widespread through Africa and South Asia, and is either a nasty invasive weed, in which case it's abused as mosquito fern, or it's a valuable addition to the ecosystem and is flattered as water velvet. But love it or hate it, from 1987 to 1997, four experiments showed an average gain of 54.3% growth with an extra 300 parts per million of CO2 in the air, and one experiment each at 600 and 900 parts per million of CO2 more extra showed another 90% and 112% growth respectively. For the Climate Discussion Nexus, I'm John Robson, hoping that more and more climate alarmists renouncing their past views is one tipping point that really doesn't reverse itself constantly.